Okay, good afternoon, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's Monday, the 16th of March, and we're going to start the sensory chapter, chapter 10, today, unless I lose my voice, chapter 10. And let's see what happened last time. You had a test last time, and that was graded. I finally got those up on Blackboard for you to see over the weekend. And you know what? I think next time we're just going to have 100 questions on the test. That way I don't have to divide by any funny number. I just add up the points and that's your score. I will cut my time probably in half for grading. Okay, so maybe we'll do that. And in lab, you get your test back in lab. Make sure you check your Scantron, and you might want to reread every question just to get a feel for how I write questions, but I'm not so sure that that's really important because I give you a lot of questions that are on the exam in the study guides already. So you can go over those study guide questions over and over and over. I know there's a lot of questions, but that's actually to your benefit because there might be a topic, okay, like this bottle right here. And if I look at the bottle over here, it says Arrowwood. But if I look on the other side, what does it say? What? It says, oh, it says Arrowhead. Oh, that's right. Did I say Arrowwood? Well, I was wrong. All right, but it's, sometimes it's handy to ask questions from different angles on the same subject so that you get more familiarity with the subject, right? All right, so that's why all those questions are really helpful for you to look at. I enabled the statistics for your particular section, so when you go onto Blackboard, you can see what your whole section did. It's not the whole class. That might be helpful to you guys. I don't know. If it really means anything, it doesn't really mean anything to me because there might be a lot of students that get between 95 and 100, and then there's some students that get maybe 25 and 30%, and so that lowers everybody's, you know, the average down quite a bit, so I'm not sure what average, if it really means anything. The only thing that means anything is your particular grade to you, and of course that's what I'm really concerned about, and I'm at a little bit of a disadvantage because I don't know anybody in here. I don't know what grades you're getting. Right, so if you want to stop by my office hours and introduce yourself to me and look over your tests and that kind of stuff, that's maybe helpful because then maybe I could ask you questions during lecture and say, hey, what about that sodium channel or something? And then that kind of puts you on the spot, but that's good because that gets you ready for the test, right? Okay. But in general, I'm pretty pleased with the test, but of course I'm concerned about a lot of students, so you just have to talk to your lab instructor or me about your particular test. The test won't be any harder from here on out compared to this time around. There were a lot of high grades, and I suppose I could get in trouble by having so much of the class do really, really well, but my impression was that the test was not easy. So you really had to apply yourself to do well on that test, so I could argue my point with just about anybody in the college, right? That those of you that did well on the test actually knew your stuff on a relatively rigorous test. So congratulations, okay, to everybody. And then again, so a lot of people did a lot better on the second test than the first, but that's not a given. And if you want to improve your scores even more, then you got to come see me and we'll just go over what it is that you have to do to study to get even better on the tests. Okay? All right, so it's definitely possible. People make big strides in this class. There seems to be a really steep learning curve. And I know it's not an easy topic in general. All right, you do have to put your time in. All right, so this chapter, anybody have a question before we get to senses? This chapter is kind of fun because now we get to apply some of that electrophysiology that you kind of just had to plow through in the initial chapters. Right, to understand how some important ways that we communicate with our environment, how that takes place. All right, so this is the senses chapter. And my point of view sometimes is a little bit different than the book, and I'll try to point that out to you. So these are some of the things we're going to be covering: vision, hearing, and equilibrium. We call these special senses, and we'll just talk a little bit about sensory receptors in general. All right, so any kind of sensory receptor is something that transduces one form of energy into another form of energy, or one kind of signal into another kind of signal. And that was one of the laws of thermodynamics, is that what energy can be converted from one form to another, but ever can't be lost. Well, when we transduce signals from one kind of energy into another kind of energy, that's not necessarily true. We always lose maybe something in the translation going from one kind of signal to another, or one energy to another, and it's kind of just lost as heat. All right, but to transduce environmental information, like what kind of environmental information might your body be interested in?
Humidity.
Yeah, humidity, temperature, maybe even diurnal cycles, like when the lights are on. Right, photo period might play a role. Well, how do these environmental energies get converted into a language that your brain understands? What's the information that your brain understands?
Chemical.
It understands chemical, yeah. Or you could say maybe electrochemical. But what is a signal that gets transmitted down an axon? Action potential. So an action potential really is the signal that your brain understands. Right, and what can you tell me about the intensity of a stimulus in your brain? How is that coded in terms of action potentials? So if you were to listen to the language of your brain, what would it sound like? And what does an action potential sound like? It's very brief, constant amplitude. It would just be what? A blip, right? Blip. And if the intensity in the environment increases, what happens to that blip? Is it the same intensity? Same amplitude?
Yeah.
Yes, it's the same amplitude, but what changes?
Frequency.
The frequency. Instead of a blip, it would be what? It would be a blip, 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 blip. That's how your brain thinks in terms of blips. And in different parts of your brain that are going blip or blip, 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 then you have different perception of reality. Like the occipital lobe. What would you experience if there are a bunch of blips in your occipital lobe? What's in your occipital lobe? Maybe from anatomy, I think you would know this. What's the function of the occipital lobe? That's vision. That's your visual cortex. Anybody know where the auditory cortex is for sound information? That's your temporal lobe. Yeah, your temporal lobe. Okay, and then somatic sensation. Sensation all over the surface of your body. Where do you appreciate that? That's in the post-central gyrus. Okay, that's in your parietal lobe. And then the precentral gyrus is what? The primary motor control. Sometimes I go over that in this class, but I found that a lot of people know that already from anatomy, so I'm not going to spend a couple of lectures talking about that. But if you're interested, go ahead and read the chapter on central nervous system, which we've kind of skipped over in here. But those are some things probably you should recall from anatomy. Okay, so to transduce a signal from energy in the environment into what? Action potentials. That's the language that your brain speaks. And fortunately, we don't hear those things with our ears because it would drive us nuts, right? All right, so that's the common language. All right, and each kind of receptor responds to a particular modality. For instance, some receptors respond to sound, some to pressure, some to light, maybe some to salt concentration, some to pH, maybe a carbon dioxide concentration. All right, and these different modalities are perceived as different because of the different parts of the brain that those signals go to. All right, so signals from the retina, where do they go? Where do signals from the retina? Vision goes to the occipital lobe. Right, and so if those axons, if we unplugged them from your occipital lobe and plugged them into your temporal lobe and light came in your eyes, what would be your perception? Then you would actually hear things that your eyes are seeing. Okay, so it's the part of the brain that gives you that consciousness, that perception. And the receptors are hooked up to those various locations. Okay? Yeah.
Does modality come from the word mode?
Probably so, yeah. Modality. Yeah. Okay. So some sensory receptors can be very simple dendritic endings of neurons. Some examples of these would be, for instance, pain and temperature are just free nerve endings. And when they get stimulated, it goes to a certain part of your brain where you experience pain or temperature, for instance. Some are very specialized endings on neurons, like this Pacinian corpuscle right here, which is going to sense deep pressure. And when this tissue is deformed, all right, when this tissue that's deep in the subcutaneous layer down here gets deformed. That causes a mechanical disruption of this membrane, which causes a stimulus on this nerve fiber. How would you describe a stimulus in terms of neurophysiology? What's a stimulus in terms of neurophysiology? And even this Pacinian corpuscle right here. If you were to squish it, guess what's going to happen? It's going to change shape, right? It's going to change the shape of the membranes, and it's going to change the shape of something that's inside that membrane. In order to stimulate something, what do you need? You need a EPSP or an IPSP? What do you need? EPSP. What causes an EPSP? A stimulus. Yeah, so we're back to asking, how do you create a stimulus in something? How would you stimulate something? You would, yeah, depolarization. How do you depolarize something? It's a perfect classical example. You open up some kind of sodium channel. So you deform the membrane of this Pacinian corpuscle, and that automatically opens up a sodium channel, and that stimulates this nerve fiber right here, right? Just by mechanically changing the membrane, opening up a sodium channel. So some sodium channels are coupled to what? Just mechanical receptors in the cell membrane. Okay, so this Meissner's corpuscle is the same. This Ruffini's end organ is pretty much the same. Just mechanical disruption of the membrane can open up sodium channels. All right, so that's just one example. Here are some other examples of receptors. We can group them according to the type of stimulus they transduce. So when we say transduce, we're saying for number one, what is number one receptor transducing?
A chemical
into what? Maybe the concentration of a chemical inside your body is being transduced into?
Electrical.
Yeah, like what's the language of your brain again?
Action potentials.
Right, so, and there are chemoreceptors, maybe for instance in your nose, right, in your mouth. There are chemoreceptors deep inside your body that monitor CO2. And so those receptors then transduce the concentration of these different chemicals into what? Action potentials that go to the brain, and then your brain figures out what that means for its own homeostasis. Photoreceptors, transduce light. What does that mean? These are receptors that can absorb light and as a result do what? Send action potentials to the brain so that your brain can have a sense of light outside the body. Where can you perceive light? Where are photoreceptors at? For instance, your retina of your eye, that's right. Thermoreceptors respond to thermal energy, temperature changes. Right, so there are thermal receptors in your hypothalamus, which controls your autonomic nervous system, whether you're going to sweat or if you're going to start shivering. There are thermal receptors all over the surface of your body. Right. So let me say something else about another kind of receptor. When you think of receptors, maybe you should think of classifying it into either a general sense or a special sense. A general sense, I'll give you a definition of a general sense. A general sense is a sense that you have all over the body. A special sense is where you can perceive some kind of energy at either one or two locations in your body, but that's about it. So for instance, if I have an ice cube and I put it on the back of your hand, can you tell that it's cold?
Yeah.
If I put it on the back of your neck, could you tell it was cold? Absolutely. Or on your back, yeah? Or on your kneecap. So you have temperature receptors where?
Everywhere.
All over your body, right? All over your body. So that's what we call a general sense. It's a general sense because you have receptors where?
Everywhere,
all over your body, okay? As opposed to, let's look at these photoreceptors right here. Where do you have photoreceptors? If I took a flashlight and shined it on your kneecap, could you see anything? No. You would feel it if it was an ice cube, right? But if it's light, no. What about your belly button? No. Your ear? No, only where? Your eyes, right? So that is what we call a special sense because you only have two locations where you can perceive that kind of stimulus, and that is your eyes, no other location. All right, so that's a special sense. What about, for instance, like something sweet? How about your fingertips? If you were to mess around with like a pile of sugar or something or salt, could you tell that was salty or sugary? No. Where? Only your tongue, for instance. So again, that's a special sense because of limited locations of where you can perceive that modality. The other thing is, for special senses, it's usually a highly organized organ that allows you that kind of perception. All right, so the special senses would be vision, only two eyes, hearing, only two ears, taste, one tongue, smell, olfaction, one nose, and then there's two more that have to do with your ear, and that's called equilibrium senses. There's static equilibrium and kinetic equilibrium, which we'll talk about toward the end of this lecture. Right? All the other senses, we're going to say, are general because you have those receptors all over your body. All right, so mechanoreceptors, we just talked about that Pacinian corpuscle that responds to deformation of their cell membrane that causes a stimulus, which does what? That opens up a sodium channel, for instance, which causes depolarization. Nociceptors respond to intense stimuli, like, for instance, maybe you're taking a chemistry lab or something and you open up a bottle to see if it was an acid in there, and maybe you didn't know, and you take a big whiff of that acid and it kind of, what, burns your nose? Well, those are stimulating nociceptors, right, in your nasal cavity. And that's going to, what, start your eyes to tear up and all that kind of stuff. So that's where you have nociceptors. But you have these kinds of pain receptors pretty much all over your body. So that's, what, a general or special sense? That's general because you have them all over your body. Now here is an interesting one. Proprioceptors. They signal a positional sense of your body parts to your brain. And proprioceptors you have in every single muscle that you have, skeletal muscle, and all your joint capsules and tendons, and even in some ligaments when they can measure tension. So because of proprioceptors, even with your eyes closed, you can tell where your body is. For instance, if I were to have somebody close their eyes and take their hand and hold it above their head, I could ask them, well, where's your right hand? And they would say, oh, well, it's above my head. And I go, where's your left hand? They go, oh, it's down by my side. So even without seeing, you know exactly where all your body parts are because of proprioceptors in muscles, in tendons and ligaments and joint capsules. All right, so is proprioception a special or a general sense?
General.
Okay, a lot of students without thinking about it would say special because proprioception is kind of a fancy term, but you're right, it's a general sense because why?
Your whole body.
See, they're all over your body, right? You got thousands, many more than thousands, maybe not a million, I don't know, maybe a million, we don't know, right? They're all over. So that is what a general sense. Okay, so we can classify them by location, right? Special senses are part of a sensory organ, one or two locations in your body, like for hearing, sight, equilibrium, and we also said, what, olfaction and gustation. What's gustation? That's taste. Yeah, taste. Gustation is taste. So we'll talk about all this kind of stuff. All right, another way of classifying receptors is how they respond to a stimulus. There are a couple different kinds, and maybe there's some in between these two different categories. There's tonic receptors versus phasic receptors. And these receptors behave differently in how they send information to the brain. But anyway, no matter how they send information to the brain, what is the language that they use to send information to the brain? Action potentials, that's it. That's the only way the brain will understand anything. Right, so if you shine a light on the occipital lobe, you won't see anything, right? You got to get action potentials in there. All right, so tonic receptors respond at a constant rate to a stimulus, right? As long as the stimulus isn't changing, and if the stimulus is maintained constant, then the frequency of action potentials will remain constant. So on this top slide right here, if we apply the stimulus and keep it on for this period of time, then it's going to be just a constant frequency of action potentials going to the brain. And of course, you know, what about the amplitude of an action potential? Well, that's not going to change ever, no matter what you do, right? Okay. So these are tonic because this receptor doesn't adapt or habituate the stimulus. If the stimulus stays on, then your brain is aware of that stimulus for that whole period of time. Okay? As opposed to a phasic receptor, let's look at a phasic receptor. When we apply the stimulus, we see a very high rate of frequency of action potentials going to the brain, and if we keep it applied at a constant level, look what happens to the frequency of action potentials. It actually decreases, over that period of time, even though the stimulus is being applied. So that means that your brain is, what, is kind of beginning to ignore the stimulus because the frequency is going down. It appears to your brain that the stimulus is actually doing what? Staying the same, increasing or decreasing? Is actually decreasing. But in this case, is the stimulus decreasing? No. It's only your perception of the stimulus that is decreasing. All right, so some good examples of that, and you're probably pretty much aware of some phasic receptors. If you walk into a building, maybe like a library or something, you're going to say, oh, well, even with your eyes closed, oh, I'm walking into a library, or I'm walking into somebody's kitchen or something during Thanksgiving or whatever, right? And then after you're there a while, what happens? You don't smell that particular odor anymore, right? So if you study in the library for an hour and you breathe, and of course you're going to continue to breathe during that whole time, after about an hour, you won't notice that, you won't smell the library because all those receptors, right, have habituated that particular stimulus. So it's the receptors that change the frequency. It's not that the neurons fatigue or it's not anything to do with your brain. It's actually the receptor that adjusts to the stimulus. All right, so do you see the difference between tonic versus phasic receptors? And touch receptors are the same way. Like if I were to grab your hand, you would feel me grabbing your hand, but if we were to hold hands for like 2 hours, well, that might be way too long. You'd probably notice. But after maybe 5 minutes, okay, what, you wouldn't even notice that somebody is holding your hand, okay? And that's probably pretty good because we're all wearing clothes. When you put your clothes on in the morning, you feel the clothes go on, but if you felt your clothes all day long, right, that might drive you nuts, okay? So those touch receptors, right, habituate that stimulus because they're phasic in nature. Okay, so stimulation of a sensory fiber evokes only the sensation of that modality. Why is that? Because where does this nerve fiber go? Where does it go? It only goes basically to one location. It goes to the location in your brain. Like fibers that are carrying visual information go to the occipital lobe. Fibers that are carrying auditory information go to the temporal lobe. So when those, and even if we stimulate those fibers with electronic equipment, okay, those are the only modalities that you will perceive. All right. The other thing is, the other concept you should be familiar with is this adequate stimulus. All right. The adequate stimulus for a receptor is the normal stimulus, and it's the kind of stimulus that will activate the receptor in the normal physiologic range of stimuli. So for instance, your retina, it usually responds to light entering your eye, but have you ever seen anything, for instance, that didn't correspond to light in the environment? Have you ever seen anything? Have you ever hit your head? Have you ever bonked your head?
Yeah.
And what do you see? You see stars, right? So some kind of mechanical deformation of the retina due to that trauma produce action potentials, and those action potentials go to the occipital lobe, and what's your perception?
Light.
It's light. Okay, so that's not an adequate stimulus, right? That is a stimulus that produced that hallucination, all right? But it's not an adequate stimulus. So the adequate stimulus for your retina is light, right? So you can stimulate all kinds of receptors. Maybe it's a pressure receptor you could stimulate by changing the pH, but that's not the adequate stimulus. The pressure receptor is most evolved to measure pressure changes. Okay. And then some receptors are a little funny in that a cold receptor. Usually we have two different kinds of receptors. We have hot receptors and cold receptors on our skin in our integument. So the cold receptor usually responds to lower than body temperature. Hot receptors respond to temperatures above body temperature. But have you ever gone into the shower and you're taking a shower and your warm receptors are saying, yeah, the shower is nice and warm. And then all of a sudden somebody does something in the house, maybe turns on a garden hose or starts the washing machine and turns the cold water on, and what's coming out of the shower now? Well, they turn the cold water on someplace, and so now you don't have cold water for the shower, so you got all this really hot water hitting your body. Now, what does that feel like? It stimulates the hot receptors, but the cold receptors respond to cold, but they also respond to way above normal temperature. All right, so we call that a paradoxical sense. When you get really, really hot water on your body, it feels what? It could feel cold because now the cold receptors are being stimulated by what? That non-adequate stimulus. Something that's way too hot, that goes way beyond your normal perception. All right, so cold receptors can be stimulated by cold, which is the usual adequate stimulus, but also by something that's really, really hot. Okay. All right, so the adequate stimulus, what, is the kind of stimulus that requires the least amount of energy to activate that particular receptor. All right, so this is how receptors work. All right, they make generator potentials. So what kind of potentials did you learn about in this class so far? Action potentials, graded potentials, all right? And now here's a third kind, generator potentials. Now what is the generator potential is yellow. Is that yellow? Good, okay, the yellow line right here. All right, so what is this? What do the yellow lines look like? Action potentials, or do they look more like graded potentials? They look more like graded potentials, and indeed, this is true. And the graded potential here is directly proportional to the strength of the stimulus. So a receptor will produce these graded potentials, and these graded potentials are basically what? EPSPs, right? And we're going to see that they, 99% of the time, are due to sodium channels that are opening up. And when a generator potential reaches threshold, guess what happens? Then an action potential is sent to the brain, right? And as the graded potential gets higher, the generator potential gets higher and higher and higher, it doesn't transmit just one action potential, it transmits what? A train of action potentials, and depending on the stimulus intensity, that increases the frequency of action potentials to the brain because these generator potentials can overcome what? This area of hyperpolarization. So that increases the frequency of action potentials going to the brain. All right, so sensory receptors generator potentials. All right, they make generator potentials, which can be used to make action potentials where does that action potential start? Yeah, axon hillock or trigger zone of a particular neuron someplace. Okay. All right, so generator potentials are proportional to stimulus intensity. After a threshold is reached, action potential frequency is proportional to the amplitude of the generator potential. All right, and in phasic receptors, the generator potential adapts to the constant stimulus and quickly diminishes in amplitude. All right, so it's not the neuron that is changing the threshold for developing an action potential. It's what? It's the receptor, right, that modifies the generator potential for a phasic kind of receptor so that your perception of that stimulus decreases over time. Okay, so tonic receptors, here we can see three different stimulus. Stimulus number one, all right, produces a really low-level generator potential. How would you talk about this generator potential? That's a sub-threshold potential because it's below threshold. And if it's a sub-threshold potential, what kind of action potentials is it going to produce?
Zero.
Zero, right? If it is barely a threshold potential, here's a second stimulus, we turn it on and then off, all right? Then, since it reaches threshold, this diagram might be a little funny, justified, because where would the first action potential be in time? It would be right about here. Well, where's the, let me go, is this where it is on the timeline for action potentials? If I was to go straight up, I'm looking at an angle. It should be where? Right here. That looks like it's a little bit to the left to me. All right. But let's just say, let's slide this over. All right. So now that produces an action potential, but the frequency is very low because the stimulus is not enough to overcome what that area of hyperpolarization or relative refractory period in that axon. So you have a low rate of action potentials going to the brain. But in our third stimulus right here, right? Not only is it threshold, but it's way above threshold. It can overcome that area of hyperpolarization, so the frequency of action potentials is much higher going to the brain. Okay, now, how would you know what sense your brain is going to perceive? All right, you can say, what, this is a low intensity, this is a high intensity, but how are you going to know what your brain is going to perceive? by this particular receptor that is making this generator potential, sending these action potentials to the brain. How are you going to know what sense you're going to perceive? What else do you have to know? Exactly right. What part of the brain these action potentials are going to? Right. So if they're going to the occipital lobe, you would have vision. If they're going to the temporal lobe, that would be auditory. Okay. So that's right. Okay. All right. So let's talk about some special senses. This is the fun part of the class. Some receptors could be grouped into receptors that respond to chemicals in the outside environment. We would call those exteroreceptors. Others respond to chemicals in the internal environment. We call those interoceptors. So there are receptors that monitor hydrogen ion concentration inside your body. So what are those receptors going to give you information about? The internal? Yeah, internal what? Internal, what's hydrogen ion concentration? That's really? Yeah, pH. That tells you what the pH of your body is, right? Okay. And there are CO2 receptors inside your body as well. All right, but a lot of times we need to communicate with our environment. We would do that with exteroceptors. So the first one we're going to talk about is gustation. That's the sense of taste. And is that a special sense or general sense? That's special because there's one place in your body that you can do that with, and that is your tongue. And your tongue has things called taste buds on it. So here's a taste bud, and if I look at this taste bud, I see a nucleus right here, and I see a cell. Now, can you see this with your naked eye? Can you see a taste bud with your naked eye? Okay. Some people are saying yes, some people no, but you know what? If I want to see a cell, it might be an age-related thing, but I need a microscope to see a cell. Okay. So in order to see a cell, you need a microscope. So if you look in the mirror and stick your tongue out and go, ah, right, you can't see these things. You can't see taste buds because they are really microscopic. Now, when you go stick your tongue out at yourself and look in the mirror, you do see things that people commonly call taste buds. But what those are, anybody know what those things are? Those are papillae. That's right. Those are just papillae that line the surface of your tongue. And you have different kinds. Can you remember from anatomy the different kinds of papillae? Depending on where on the tongue it is, you have what, the circumvallate papillae and different kinds of papillae. There's teeny ones and then there's bigger ones. Well, the papillae are lined with these guys. So you have thousands and thousands of taste buds on every papillae. Right? So what you look at with your naked eye is not really a taste bud, for instance. Okay, and in one taste bud you have numerous cells. You might have 50 to 100 taste cells in every particular taste bud. So every papilla has what? Oh, many thousands, tens of thousands of taste cells. So these cells have these little hairs sticking out of them, and it's not like hair that we have on the top of our head. These are more like cilia, but they kind of look like hair sticking off. So they're named hair cells, and then there are receptors on these taste hairs that can bind various kinds of molecules. And this is a matter of debate, but there are basically about five different kinds of hair cells or taste cells, right, that have receptors for molecules like sugars, molecules that are acidy, right, that produces a sour sense. Salt would be, what would be an example of a chemical that produces a salty taste in your mouth? Yeah, sodium would be a good example of that. All right, some others would be a bitter sense, and then umami is a sense of deliciousness. So maybe it's not going to be sweet or sour or whatever, but when you eat it, it gives you a sense of fulfillment or satisfaction, okay, when you taste it. All right, so it's kind of a more subtle sense. All right, so these are what we call the primary taste sensations. We got five of them right here. Not everybody agrees with these five primary taste sensations, but every food is going to be what? Some combination of these five primary sensations. Right, so you can tell if it's strawberry or lemon or whatever by how much sweetness you taste or how much acidity you taste, for instance. Okay, so those molecules we call tastants. All right, and then So the taste cell generates what? Generator potentials. And then that stimulates the nerve right here, which then takes that information to the brain. So here's what the taste cells really look like. I think I got these from your book. All right, so how many different primary taste sensations did we have? I think about 5 of them. All right, so let's talk about salt. And salt, you could probably design for yourself and imagine how salt would work. Because in order for you to taste salt, what do you have to do? Put sodium inside your mouth, okay? And how would we stimulate a cell? How would we depolarize a cell? We just let sodium go into that cell. And indeed, these taste cells have a sodium channel right here. And they're always there. They're always open. So when sodium concentration goes up inside your mouth, guess where that sodium goes? Right through this channel, through the cell membrane. And when sodium goes through the cell membrane, what happens to the cell membrane? It depolarizes. Right? And then when it gets down to the more basal ends of the cell, here are some voltage-gated calcium channels that open up. Calcium enters the cell. That causes release of neurotransmitter, and this neurotransmitter is excitatory. That is going to cause a graded potential, which can be converted into action potentials, and that action potentials go to the brain as a result of that. Now, if somebody wants to do Google and find out what kind of excitatory neurotransmitter this is, that's fine, but I'm not going to test you on that or grade you on that, but you can tell me next time. Okay? All right, so that's for salt. Sodium just goes right through that ion channel. Sour, I said, was due to acid. What's the chemical compound that makes something acidic? Yeah, a hydrogen ion. All right, so there are hydrogen ion channels. And these are strictly hydrogen ion channels. They won't work for calcium or potassium or sodium. Very specific kind of channel, so that when the pH in your mouth decreases, the sodium enters. And what's it going to do to the cell membrane? Potential. It's going to depolarize the cell. And again, that depolarization is going to cause calcium channels to open up. So these are voltage-gated calcium channels, which then cause docking and fusion of these synaptic vesicles that releases excitatory neurotransmitter, which then sends action potentials to the brain when hydrogen ion concentration increases. All right, so is all that pretty obvious? That's really straightforward, I think, yeah, how that works. All right, and then what about our remaining 3 senses? The remaining 3 work through G-protein-coupled receptors. Ooh, okay, but you're familiar with G-protein-coupled receptors because you've looked at them for months already and could draw them out. All right, so here is the receptor molecule, and don't forget the receptor molecule is coupled to what? G proteins that can float around on the inside of the membrane. So sweet molecules like what? Like sugar, like glucose or sucrose or whatever binds to this receptor right here that activates G proteins, which then causes the formation of a second messenger inside the cell. That second messenger, okay, it will bind to potassium channels, causing these potassium channels to close. Now, what happens when a potassium channel closes? Or what happens when a potassium channel opens? Let's go back to the very beginning. When a potassium channel opens, what happens? It makes the membrane potential greater. It hyperpolarizes, right? So a potassium channel, when it's open, causes hyperpolarization. So when you close a potassium channel, what happens? The opposite happens, and that is depolarization. All right, that depolarization causes release of neurotransmitter, which then sends action potentials to the brain. And how does your brain know that it's a sweet or an umami sensation? Because it's connected to the right part of your cerebral cortex. So if we were to take this neuron and hook it up to your occipital lobe, what would be your perception if you were to put some sugar on your tongue? Yeah, you'd have a sense of vision. I don't know, it wouldn't relate to anything very useful, right? But I'm just trying for you to understand how you perceive things. It's by what gets stimulated in your cerebral cortex, right? So this neuron has to be connected to the proper cells of the gustatory cortex. All right, the sense of bitter, again, is due to a G-protein-coupled receptor that activates G-proteins, which increases the second messenger. Okay, which does a couple of things, right? It can open up the sarcoplasmic reticulum, but this is just an endoplasmic reticulum that is specialized for sequestering calcium. This opens up calcium channels, which then floods the inside of the cell, and that calcium signal then causes the fusion and release of neurotransmitter from this cell, which then causes action potentials that goes to the right, the bitter area of your brain for the sense of bitterness. All right, so you see some, for hydrogen ion and for sodium, some direct ion channels, but the other senses are due to these G-protein-coupled receptors. All right, so that's the sense of gustation or taste. So probably you should know the five general senses, okay, and probably know what kind of receptor on the tongue, where are the receptors on the tongue, what kind of cell are they? What kind of cell has these receptors? What is this guy right here? It's a bad cell with a crew cut. It's what? It's a hair cell, right? I'm not making fun of anybody that has a crew cut. It's just about a hair cell. Kind of all shaved off. Okay. Yes. Yes. Yeah, so sweet, umami, and bitter.
So there is no depolarization on
bitter state? Let's see. No, there's no depolarization right here. Yeah, so we don't need depolarization. This second messenger right here works on the endoplasmic reticulum, which releases the calcium signal. Okay. Yeah, so it's not a electrically coupled kind of receptor system. Right, it's just a second messenger that works on the endoplasmic reticulum. But for sweet and umami, right, that causes depolarization. Right, so these are exam figures, so you should get the feel for these things, how those work. All right, next sense, olfaction, that's a sense of smell. And, of course, that's a special sense because that's only in your nose. All right, and here's a nasal cavity. Oh, there's a probably inferior nasal concha. Here's your middle nasal concha right here. And look at what you have inside your nasal cavity, especially in this region. Right on the roof of the nasal cavity you have, and this is really strange, highly atypical, this part of your body, you actually have neurons that are just kind of dangling outside your body. So can you imagine what kind of life they have? Where are most neurons? Deep inside your body. They're protected by your internal environment. What about these guys right here? Well, they have a really hard life, right? Because they're just out there with whatever is in the room, and you might be breathing car exhaust or, you know, who knows what by accident, right? So these neurons have a really hard life. They have a very limited lifespan, okay? And these come from where? The olfactory bulb, this is again some nice review of anatomy. What bone is this right here? Yeah, that's the ethmoid bone. That's the ethmoid bone. And the ethmoid bone is a really cool bone. One of the things that it has a cribriform plates with all these holes in it. What do we call all these holes? Passageways for these olfactory nerves. That's the olfactory foramina, so that these nerves can exit the olfactory bulb and dangle down right here in the nasal cavity. And there are receptors, okay, on these nerve endings that can bind various kinds of odorant molecules or odors. So let's zoom into this region right here so we can see the cribriform plate, the olfactory foramina. And we have the olfactory receptor cells, and look what they have. They have like hairs on them as well, cilia. For some reason, we don't call these hair cells. Now, what can you tell me about the shape of this neuron? What does it look like to you?
Bipolar,
very good. That's the flashback from anatomy, right? You could think of a multipolar or unipolar. Well, here's a nice bipolar neuron. And so odorant molecules have to bind to receptors on these cilia, and that's going to cause action potentials to go up to these ganglion cells and then going to send signals via these mitral. You don't have to know the names of these cells, right? You just have to know where olfaction is, and that odorant molecules have to bind to these olfactory receptor cells. Now, the other interesting thing, besides the olfactory receptor cells that we have right here, we have some other support cells. We have supporting cells and basal cells. The receptor cells, of course, are the bipolar neurons. The basal cells are stem cells. Now, that should be interesting to a lot of people. Because what does a stem cell have the ability to do? Yeah, to produce more neurons, because we're talking about nerve tissue. And what have you learned about the nervous system and its regenerative capabilities? It's almost non-existent because there aren't stem cells anywhere. But now where do you know, where are there stem cells for neurons? Yeah, in your nose, right? So I'm sure somebody's looking into that. It'd be really cool, somebody with a spinal cord injury, right, to be able to take some cells out of their nose, maybe culture them, transplant them to somebody's spinal cord, and have them regenerate connections of a spinal cord, and then they could move again. That would be really wonderful in order for that to happen. More complicated than it seems to do that, though, however. But what might you be concerned about? Well, then you're going to smell with your back. Okay? All right, so we'd have to trick those cells not to be olfactory receptors, but just to carry action potential. So I was sort of being a little silly there, but at least you caught on. And the other supporting cells are just detoxifying cells that help detoxify all the other chemicals that we have in the environment that are trying to just, you know, kill all these cells there in your nose. There is discussion of how many primary sensations we have for smell. All right, so we said there's only five for gustation, but there's a lot of disagreement in the literature, and it might actually vary from individual to individual, but there are thousands. Each of us might have 2,000 different kinds of primary smell sensations. Some of them could be etheric, like ether or flowery, okay? And it's pretty easy to find the list of these, but it's not very useful to just memorize that whole list. So the gene family for olfactory receptors is what? Huge. And there probably is a lot of individual variation for it. Nonetheless, they all act through G protein coupled receptors, which then send action potentials to the brain. But odorant molecules have to bind to those receptor cells, those bipolar cells. Okay, hearing. All right, so hearing is involved with your ears. And there is the vestibular apparatus, which is the bony labyrinth for three important senses. And the three important senses would be hearing, and then two for equilibrium. Static, I'll abbreviate it equilibrium, EQ, and then kinetic. Equilibrium. All right, so those are all associated with your ear. Now, what part of your ear is going to sense these different modalities right here? Okay, that's your inner ear. And where do you find your inner ear? What bone is it in? What bone is that right there? Okay. What bone is this right here? That's the mastoid process of the temporal bone, yeah. So that apparatus for hearing is in the temporal bone. And then there's a region of the temporal bone. What's a region? It's between the external auditory meatus and the internal. There's that, like that little hump in the temporal bone. What's that called? That's called the petrous region of the temporal bone. Is any of this coming back?
Yeah.
A little bit? Okay. Petrous region of the temporal bone. And inside that is the vestibular apparatus right here. And the vestibular apparatus has got three main parts to it. There's this part that kind of looks like a snail. That's the cochlea, right? And then there's the vestibule, which is the center part right here. And then there are the three semicircular canals, here, here, and here. Those are the three parts. And how many senses did I say you had in your inner ear? Three. And I just pointed out three parts, and guess what? One of those parts correspond to each of these areas right here. All right, so the bony labyrinth for hearing is the cochlea. Oh, I misspelled it already. Cochlea. The bony labyrinth for static equilibrium is the vestibule. And the bony labyrinth for kinetic equilibrium is the, oops, I misspelled it already. Semicircular canals. All right, so can you see those things on the diagram? Yeah. And what's coming out of each one of these areas? You have nerves, okay? And this used to be called the auditory nerve, And that's what made that acronym so easy to remember when you're trying to remember the cranial nerves. What's that little, no, it was a mnemonic, sorry, the mnemonic. What was the mnemonic? Like, on old Olympus's towering top, a fin in German, viewed a hop. And everybody asked me, well, how come today we call this the vestibulocochlear nerve, and in the mnemonic it's an A, because it used to be called the auditory nerve. But it not only goes to the cochlea for hearing, it also goes to the vestibule and the semicircular canals for the sense of equilibrium. So it's called what? The vestibulocochlear nerve now, because it carries all of those senses to the brain. Okay? Okay. So inside the vestibular apparatus, you have some organs for these senses, and you also have some fluid in the inner ear compartment. And in one of the compartments, we call that endolymph. There's a fluid in there. You have receptor cells. And all of these receptor cells are mechanoreceptors. They respond to deformation of the cell membrane. When the membrane changes shape, that's going to cause action potentials or generator potentials. Those generator potentials are going to send action potentials to the brain. And in particular, what part of the brain is this auditory nerve going to send signals to? I like that temporal lobe. Okay. All right, so let's talk about some of these different organs. Here we have, in the vestibule, the utricle and saccule. Here are two organs for static equilibrium, right here. And a part of the apparatus that allows us that positional sense in the utricle and saccule is called the maculae. And the maculae have what we call otoliths on them. Where is that on the side? Ah, otolith organs. Now, an otolith is a crystal of calcium carbonate. It's like a rock. All right? And that rock has a certain amount of weight, and so gravity can pull on that weight, and that weight is attached to the receptor cells, and that's going to change the bending of that plasma membrane, and that can either increase or decrease action potentials going to the brain. So we do have little crystals inside our vestibular apparatus that are components of the maculae, which are the utricle and saccule right here. Let's see, which sense do I talk about first? Well, I talk more a little bit about the general architecture of the vestibular apparatus. All right, so here you see the endolymph in the cochlea, the endolymph in the vestibule, and also endolymph in the semicircular canals. All right, that's located within the bony labyrinth that I have on the board right here. Okay, so the utricle and saccule provide us the sense of linear acceleration, which is what? Static equilibrium. What's acceleration? Okay, not moving the constant speed, but changing your speed. All right, so going say 10 miles an hour and then going to 60 miles an hour. That's acceleration during that time. Or going the reverse. Say you're going 60 and then you slow down and stop. That's what we call deceleration. So these receptors can't give you any information if your velocity is constant, but it's what, a change in velocity that is constant. All right, so if you're sitting in a car and your back is up against the seat and you're sitting at a stoplight, you're not resting a lot of weight on your back up against the chair, but as soon as you hit the accelerator, where do you feel a lot of pressure? Okay, because you accelerate forward, that throws your back up against the chair and you feel pressure on your back. All right, so that's an acceleration. And then, what happens if you were to stop all of a sudden? Which way would your body go? Would go forward, you'd lean away, and then if you hit the steering wheel, you'd feel a lot of pressure on your anterior part of your body, right? That would be deceleration, right? So, but even if you're not moving right now, there is something that's a little funny, and that is the way that gravity works, okay? So right now, where do I feel gravity? For me, on my feet, right? I can feel my feet touching the ground, right, if I think about it, not if I'm not thinking about it. So gravity is accelerating you all the time, even though I'm not moving, which is different than the car. Which way is gravity like accelerating me? It's like trying to accelerate me up. That's what gravity is doing. Actually, it's pulling me down. But gravity is acceleration. So these receptors right here, since they measure acceleration, they can feel gravity they can always give you the sense of what is down as a result of that. So even though you're not moving, you have that positional sense because gravity acts like acceleration on that part of the ear. Okay, I might have to come back to this slide. So for instance, here is a receptor cell that's in your ear, and guess what we call the name of the cell right here? That's a hair cell, okay, because it has these things that somebody called a hair at one time. They maybe are analogous to hairs, but these are stereocilia. These are special types of cilia, and they're all kind of attached to each other, and then there's one that's called the kinocilium. And when the kinocilium is bent, it can open and close various channels, ion channels, which then can affect, what, depolarization or repolarization of the membrane right here, which is going to, if it bends one way, it's going to increase frequency of action potential is going to the brain. If it bends the other way, it's going to inhibit that cell. And so you'll have a decreased action frequency of action potential is going to the brain, depending on what the orientation of the cell is with respect to gravity. All right, so let me show you. Okay, here's the maculae inside the utricle and saccule. So here is what a macula looks like. All right, so you have some kind of basement membrane, and then you have these cells right here. What are these cells? These are the hair cells, right? Do you see the cilia poking up off the membrane? But where are they poking? They're poking up into something that looks like jello right here. Right, so we just call that a gelatinous mass. And then on top of this gelatin, right, it's not watery at all. On top of the gelatin, you have the crystals of calcium carbonate. So these are the weights. Right, so when somebody is with their head erect facing forward, right, these weights are pushing straight down. And when they push straight down, they don't bend the stereocilia one way or the other. But now look what happens. Even though the person doesn't move, maybe they just tilt their head forward. Now what happens? All right, so the orientation of the hair cells changes. Gravity pulls down on the otolith, which then causes that gelatinous mass to kind of sag. And when it starts to sag, what does it do to the stereocilia? It bends it, right? And that's going to change the rate of action potential is going to the brain. And what happens instead of tilting their head forward, if somebody tilts their head backward, what happens? Their hair cells bend the opposite way, and then that changes action potentials in the opposite direction. So these receptors right here of the utricle and saccule just respond to the position of your head, whether you're tilting your head forward or backwards or what, standing erect, or if you're lying down on a bed, that's going to change the action potentials going to the brain. So you don't necessarily have to be moving, so that's why we call this static equilibrium, because gravity works like acceleration on what, these otoliths. Gravity is pulling them down. That's like what? That's like being accelerated up, right? That would bend the stereocilia the same way. So if you were to get into an elevator, all right, that would bend these cilia exactly the same way. All right, so that gives you a sense of body position. Okay, the semicircular canals. All right, so the utricle and saccule are right here, right? And that's got the maculae in it with those otolith organs, the hair cells. All right, so now let's look at kinetic equilibrium. And kinetic equilibrium is due to the fluid inside the semicircular canals. And let's look at the base of one semicircular canal. Can you see this little bulge right here? And that kind of looks like a little vial that maybe somebody would draw some material up to give somebody an injection or something. What's another name for a vial of a fluid compound for medical purposes? Sometimes it's called an ampule. Yeah. And so that's why they call this organ right here the crista ampullaris, because it's in this little bulge of the semicircular canal. And it has hair cells in it as well, and a gelatinous mass. All right, so let me see if I got a picture of it. Yeah, here's the crista ampullaris. And did you see where, can you picture where this crista ampullaris is? Can I go back? It's right in this region right here. And how many do you have in each ear? You got one, two, three, corresponding to the three semicircular canals. And what these do, they give you a sense of angular acceleration or spinning or rotation, however you want to think about it, for the following reason. So let's go back to this slide right here. Before we go, now what do you have inside the semicircular canals, this whole area right here? This whole length is fluid, that's endolymph, all right? And that endolymph, all right, can flow through this chamber in what kind of motion? This nice circular motion. And how many planes do we need to describe the space that we live in? Yeah, three, right? So you got a coronal plane, you got a transverse plane, and you got a sagittal plane. And if I give anybody three coordinates with those three planes, we know exactly where in the room you are, right? So three planes can completely describe our environment. So you have three organs right here for rotational acceleration. So you can tell if you're accelerating or twisting in what? Any of these three planes. And if you're twisting in some direction that's not on one of those planes, then, right, these are just like for taste. What were the primary sensations? You had five of them, okay? But for angular acceleration, there are three planes that can completely describe how you're going to be spinning in space, okay? You only need three planes to do that. So you have three primary sensations for spinning. So how does that work? Okay? So here is endolymph within the semicircular canal. It can flow past the crista ampullaris. So here's the little bulge here, the hair cells. And then the gelatinous mass for the crista ampullaris is called the cupula. Right? It's not necessarily really attached to the roof of the crista ampullaris right here, but it can bend one way or the other. And why would it want to bend? It has to do with the property of inertia. What is inertia? It sounds like a physics class. I need a piece of paper. Can I give this back to you in just a little bit? I won't destroy it too much. Oh, that's a nice diagram there. Okay, so what does inertia mean? Anybody have an idea what the heck inertia means? You forgot. Okay, we'll review a little bit. Anybody have an idea what inertia is? Yeah. I like that. Okay. The inertia is a property of matter, which has mass. And that is, when mass has velocity, it's going to have a tendency to stay in motion. All right, so that's a property of matter. If something is in motion, it's going to have a tendency to stay in motion unless something stops it. So, for instance, if you get your car up to 60 miles an hour and then put it in neutral, your car is going to keep going. It's going to slow down because something is stopping. What's stopping a car if you take your foot off the accelerator? It's just friction due to the air that's pushing up against the car that's going to slow. But if you're in space and got the car going, your car would just go forever and ever until it ran into a planet or something, right? Okay. All right, so that's a property of inertia. The other property of inertia is that when something is stopped, guess what? It likes to stay stopped. It doesn't like to get into motion. All right, so that's why a lot of times when people say, oh, I just don't feel like starting to study for this exam yet, they say, oh, there's just too much inertia. Right, because I just don't feel like starting. So inertia is two things. Once something is moving, it likes to keep moving, doesn't like to stop. But if something stopped, it doesn't like to start. All right, so that's inertia. So I could demonstrate this to you. So let's say that we have some endolymph in this bottle right here. Okay, my little water bottle. Okay, good enough. So endolymph is in your ear. And if it's not moving, what is it like to do? Stay still. So I can apply some force to this bottle, right? But it's not going to move like that. All right, so it didn't move, right? It just stayed right there. I moved the paper how? Really rapidly, if there was no inertia to the mass of this bottle, it would have gone right along with the paper. All right, so that's one thing. Now, what's another example of inertia? Once you get something moving, it doesn't want to do what? Doesn't want to stop. So let me move the paper and stop it here and see what happens to the bottle. I can't do it real fast because I'll leave the bottle behind. So let me give myself a little way. So I'll start the bottle and then I'll stop it. Oop, the bottle kept moving even though I stopped the paper. What is that called? That's called inertia. Okay. So here we got endolymph. So now we can look at the slide. I didn't know where that belonged. Okay. So endolymph is mass. It has inertia. And so what kind of motion is kinetic motion? It is spinning or twisting or what we call rotational acceleration. So let's just say that we're standing still. Right, we're standing still for a long period of time. What about fluid in the semicircular canals? Like, let's look at this horizontal one right here. If you've been standing still for a long time, what's the motion of fluid in this semicircular canal? It's still, it's stationary, right? Okay, and now let's start spinning in this plane right here. What's going to happen? Well, since the vestibular apparatus is connected to your skull, right, and you start to turn your skull, what about your vestibular apparatus? It moves with your skull. But now what about the fluid, that endolymph, inside the semicircular canal? It's going to want to stay stationary, right? Just like this bottle, right? When I tried to move the bottle. All right, so if the crista ampullaris is moving through space, but the endolymph is stationary, what's that going to do to these hair cells? That's going to push or pull on the hair cells. Right? And when these hair cells deform, that's going to set up action potentials going to the brain because of the kinocilium right here. So when you start to spin, right, you get that sense of spinning. And then here's the cool part, which you all did, maybe even last night, I'm not sure. So you spin for a long period of time, and then you stop, and what happens to your world when you look at it? It's spinning what? The opposite direction, because what's happening? If you spin for a long period of time, what are you doing to the endolymph? You're getting it to spin with you, right? If you do it for a long period of time, and then if you stop, what happens to the endolymph? It's still going, and it pushes on the cupula the opposite way, that bends those kinocilium the opposite way, and you get that sense of motion. It's kind of an inappropriate sense, but what? It's the endolymph still losing its motion that causes that disequilibrium. Okay? So That's what you feel from spinning. But it doesn't just happen in a left-right direction. It could be forwards and backwards, left-right. What's another way you can spin? I don't know. There's three ways you can spin. Okay, this way, and some other way. Okay, that's due to inertia of the endolymph. All right, so let's see. Let me finish this out. So This is the sense. All right, this is what? The bony labyrinth. Okay. What about the organ? I might have to modify this table. What about the self? All right, so we haven't talked about hearing yet, except for cochlea. So what's the organ for static equilibrium inside the vestibule? What's the organ? Right, yeah, actually they both contain maculae. Okay, so the utricle and saccule both contain that otolith organ for the sense of linear acceleration. What about the organ for kinetic equilibrium, which is what? Spinning. What organ is that? That's the crista ampullaris. That's that one. All right. Now, what about the cell? What kind of cells make generator potentials? Oh, what about for the crista ampullaris? Is that up there? That's up there. That's a hair cell. What about for linear acceleration? Hair cell. Okay, let's move on to the next sense of the inner ear, okay, and that is hearing. All right, so sound is a wave, okay, and light is a wave, but they're really two different, radically different kinds of waves. Light is an electromagnetic wave. So it has electrical and magnetic components to it. But sound is a mechanical wave. Sound is a pressure wave that increases and decreases as it moves through the air. So it's a mechanical wave. So in order for you to hear sound, you don't need electromagnetic receptors like you do in your eyes. You need what kind of receptors in your ear if it's a mechanical wave? You need mechanical receptors because it's a mechanical wave, which is a variation in pressure. Okay? All right, so sound waves, which is a mechanical wave, travel in all directions from its source. The waves are characterized by frequency and intensity. All right, so here is a low frequency wave. Here is a high frequency wave. All right, so this is going to sound like a low note. This is going to sound like a high note, and anything in between will be in between kind of notes. And if it's low intensity, all right, then the amplitude is going to be really low. All right, so this will be hard to hear. That will be really easy to hear. Did you guys ever use the audiometer in lab yet? No? Oh. Ask your instructor. Pull it out and use that. That's fun to use to get your hearing checked. Okay. Any people in the Navy here? Maybe there are. They just can't hear me anymore. Okay, because there used to be a lot of bad noise, a lot of high frequency noise on ships that would just burn out people's ears as a result of that. So there might be a few Navy types in here. Okay, so that is intensity, right, and that is frequency. So how is it that you can hear different frequencies and different intensities? So let's look at the ear. Okay, all right, so here's your ear, kind of a from anatomy. And you can see your outer ear, your middle ear, and your inner ear. And so far, we've only been talking about what? The inner ear, namely the vestibule and the semicircular canals. But now we're going to start talking about hearing. So you need the remainder, the rest of the parts of the ear, in order to hear anything. So you need your external ear to funnel sound waves in through the external auditory meatus. They're going to bounce up against this tympanic membrane right here, causing it to vibrate back and forth if all is well. Okay, and so this is just going to be a variation above and below atmospheric pressure. And how is it that pressure is equalized from your middle ear compartment to your external ear right here? Because this tympanic membrane should be continuous. There shouldn't be any holes in it. So what equalizes pressure on either side of the tympanic membrane so that the tympanic membrane just doesn't, like, bulge out or bulge in when there's a change in atmospheric pressure? Because you want it to vibrate right around atmospheric pressure so that you can hear sounds like those waves right there. Have you heard of the tympanopharyngeal tube? I don't know, the anatomy book had a really weird name for it. But there's another name called eustachian tube, right? There's another name called auditory tube. Pharyngotympanic tube is what your anatomy book calls it, because it's a tube that goes from your pharynx, your throat, up into the middle ear right here. Okay, so that equalizes pressure with the atmosphere, unless this becomes plugged, like for instance when you have a cold or something like that, and you have a hard time hearing things because your ears are plugged up because this pharyngotympanic tube is blocked. All right, and when the tympanic membrane bounces back and forth, it vibrates these auditory ossicles back and forth. And then that vibrates the base of the stapes. Can you remember some of the names of these little bones right here, auditory ossicles? And this is the oval window that introduces pressure waves into the endolymph of what? The vestibular apparatus. So that's how sound goes from your outside world into the fluid that makes up your inner ear. And so this, what size membrane is bigger? Is the tympanic membrane bigger or the oval window bigger? Yeah, tympanic membrane is much, much bigger in terms of surface area because sound has difficulty leaving the air and going into fluid. Right? So maybe, have you ever been in a pool swimming sometime and your head is underwater, your ears are underwater, and somebody's talking to you outside the pool? Can you hear them? No, because sound waves just don't like to penetrate water. Once they're in water, they transmit very nicely. Okay, but sound energy does not like to go from air into water, so your ear has to be designed to force that energy in, to allow that energy into the aqueous environment of your inner ear. And so this acts as an amplification system, all right, so that sound can enter your inner ear right here, all right, by just looking at the size of the tympanic membrane to the size of this oval window right here. So now you have sound, in the cochlea, all right? Because the cochlea is what? The bony labyrinth for hearing, all right? And then it's going to go through a couple tubes that make up the cochlea, all right? So here you see your tympanic membrane, right, the malleus, incus, and stapes. If sound gets too loud, there's even some muscles attached to these bones to keep them from vibrating too much. Right, like the stapedius muscle is in there that helps protect your ear from sounds that are very loud. All right, so the stapes introduces pressure waves into the fluid, and we call this the perilymph on the outside. And then right on the inside, this is where we have the endolymph that I mentioned previously. All right, so you got three tubes. You got the scala vestibuli, which is connected to the oval window. All right, sound can move all the way to the end of the cochlea. What's the end of the cochlea called? That's the helicotrema. And then it enters the scala tympani, and what allows that pressure to escape from your middle ear. If it didn't escape from, I'm sorry, from your inner ear. If it didn't escape from your inner ear, it would actually fracture all those bones in there. So what allows that pressure to actually leave your inner ear? That's a round window right here. Okay. And the tube that's on the inside, right, is what we call the cochlear duct. And the cochlear duct has endolymph in it. And the cochlear duct has, right, here's remember what that cochlea looks like? What does it look like? It's all wound up. Okay? And why is it all wound up like that? Because in its essential nature, it's really, really long, right? And it would be sticking out your ears if it was just straight. So what's a way so it doesn't stick out your ears? You have it coiled up, right? So let's uncoil it so that it's straight, because it's easier to see when it's straight. So here it is when it's straight. All right, now let's look down from the top. All right, so let's look down from the top, and it doesn't look like a line from the top. If we look down from the top, it looks like this. Ooh. All right, a little confusing with the words that I have on the board. But where is the thickest part, the longest part of the cochlea in the dimension that on this line is going in and out of the board? Where's the thickest part? It's down by the, what end is this? This is called the, that's the helicotrema. All right, and where is it the thinnest? It's the thinnest way down by the oval window. Okay, so what does that kind of remind you of? What does that kind of remind you of? Okay, kind of like a megaphone, okay? What I'm actually thinking of, let's put some strings in here. All right, we'll put some strings in here. Now, what does that remind you of? Yeah, it reminds you of a harp, right? Or maybe a piano, okay? Because how is a piano laid out? If you hit one end of the piano, it plays like a low note, right? If you hit the other end, it plays a high note. And why is that? Because it's the length of the strings, right? So short things have a tendency to vibrate fast, have a high frequency. Things that are really long have a tendency to vibrate at a lower frequency just by their shape, right? So there is a structure-functional relationship. So in terms of the cochlea, what part vibrates at a low frequency? Down by the helicotrema. Why? Because that's the longest dimension inside the cochlea. Right? And then the parts that are closest to the oval window vibrate at a high frequency because it's short. And in between are what? Intermediate frequencies. So when energy comes in the oval window, it will jump from the scala vestibuli through the cochlear duct and into the scala tympani right here. Right, based on the width of the cochlea at that location. Right, so the characteristic frequency of vibration is just going to be determined by the width of the cochlea. So low frequencies are over here, intermediate frequencies are right here, and then there's high frequencies right here. So your cochlea is really acting like what kind of instrument? Yeah, it's acting like a piano or a harp or something just because of the shape. All right, and that's going to stimulate these cells. So we're going to have to pick up next time what these cells look like right here. So when low frequencies come in, it causes action potentials from this region of the cochlea. When high frequencies come in, it causes action potentials from this region, and then these different regions send action potentials to the brain, and guess what you have in your brain? You've got, like, pianos in your brain, okay, that listen for action potentials. And that's how you can hear notes or chords or even how you can interpret language, for instance.
Did you look at Freeman, like, the center of it?
Yeah, yeah, that's the very center. And in the diagram, you don't necessarily notice that's the thickest part because you just have, what, a two-dimensional flat picture. Yeah, but it's actually, yeah, very good. Thank you for the sign-in sheet. Hey, who needs a sign-in sheet? Anybody need the sign-in sheet? Yeah, come on down. I'll leave it right here. Yeah.